Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 9 of the Chris Chambers Noir Show, where this award-winning, best-selling noir author shines a light on some of the top writers in the noir space. This month, we have the honor of hosting two award-winning and best-selling exemplars of hard-boiled crime fiction, Reed Farrell Coleman and Delia Pitts. Writing about what happens in the shadows is a craft, or what's the art? That's Chris's question. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio, where we also blast out on Spotify, iHeart, and Apple podcasts, and on our YouTube channel, incandescent.tv. Before I turn this Q&A that is going to be fascinating, I know, over to Chris, let me tell you about this month's guests. Reed Farrell Coleman was called a hard-boiled poet by NPR's Maureen Corrigan and the Noir Poet Laureate of the Huntington Post. A New York Times bestselling author of 31 novels, probably more by now, possibly. And some of his titles include the Nick Ryan series and the Robert B. Parker's Jesse Stone series, which I'm a huge fan of. When I met him last year, I was fanning all over that because that was such a good series. Reed is a 4-time Edgar Award nominee in 3 different categories: Best Novel, Best Paperback Original, and Best Short Story. He's also a 4-time recipient of the Seamus Award for Best PI Novel of the Year. Amazing. Also with us today is the wonderful Delia Pitts, who said that pursuing a doctorate in African American history and a career in the U.S. Foreign Service reinforced her interest in people, places, and writing. Though the settings were not quite as exotic as West Africa, her subsequent career as a university administrator took her to Texas, New Jersey, and around the world. She jumped into the world of fiction writing through a stimulating and fun adventure of fan fiction. To date, she has published more than 60 fan fiction stories under the pen name Blacktop. Wondering what inspires her for murder mysteries? Southside Chicago relatives are involved, she said, or how her earliest job as a copy boy jump-started her writing career. That's what we're going to find out today. So thank you all for being here. Chris, over to you.
Thank you so much. And it's, again, excuse me, I'm so nervous because, you know, these are my idols here. I got to
Chris, you got to up your game.
There I go. Okay. I am so honored to have you guys here. Miss Delia, it is a pleasure, you know, and I have to tell you, Trouble in Queenstown and Death of an Ex, you know, that's it. You know, you're doing it. You're setting it on fire.
Thank you. And
Reed, you know, my idol for a long time. Now, I got to, in case Mr. Pelicanos is listening, George, you're still Batman to my Robin. You're still my mentor, but this guy is an idol. Okay. So just, just wanted to get any feelings hurt here. Maureen Corrigan, who's down here in DC with me, referred to Reed as the hard boiled poet. I like to call him the poet of the hard boiled. That way I don't have to give her any, you know, like royalty credit, number one. And, you know, and it fits into the theme, you know, of art and craft. So we can stop right here. I mean, hey, thank you very much, everybody.
All right, take care, guys.
but, you know, yeah, definitely one of my heroes, the Bard of Sheepshead Bay. that'll be a new one. That I can copyright.
Right.
But because everybody... You know, if people don't know who you guys are, then we're doing something wrong. I'm not going to go into any weird icebreaker. And again, let me remind everybody, we are here on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and our bright smiling faces are on YouTube and the Incandescent Radio Network. And we're here with Reed Farrell Coleman and Delia Pitts. So I'm going to start with Reed. And put you on the spot for a minute, and then we'll go to Delia and put her on the spot. And she looks, she's getting all crazy here. You know, that Chicago and New Jersey.
Too worried, Chris.
Yeah. That's true. But you can't tell with these Chicago and New Jersey people. She could have an ice pick on her lap, and I wouldn't know that. let me go this. The first novel of yours that I ever read, and I was working on my hardcover for Random House. It was Walking the Perfect Square, and I was reading the book, and I was working on my manuscript, and I just met Gary Phillips, and I said, Gary, I can't compete with this stuff. I mean, why am I bothering? This stuff is amazing. And he said, oh, just keep going, just keep going. And right from the beginning, I mean, even Megan Abbott's foreword, which should be published in and of itself, of that book of Walking the Perfect Square, it was really meaty, and it probably went to the art more than the craft, because after that the prose were just bam bam bam. And let me give you this quote, speaking of meat, because this is what really put me over the edge, that there's no way I could compete with this. Let me see if this sounds familiar. Eating ribs on a second date takes nerve. It's difficult to look suave gnawing on dead pig bones and licking red goo off your fingers. And scraping sinew out from between your teeth always drives them wild. Damn. Okay, now, and that's Mo Prager. Now, let's pivot. Now you got Nick Ryan. And am I full of shit? And we can use those words here. Yeah. Don't worry. Am I full of shit if I posit that you artfully have been able to create a Mo kind of almost a schlub, and then you've got Nick, who's a soldier. And but you know, you've basically engineered the stories, but the art is bringing them to life. I mean, now, are you mad if I call Mo a schlub and Nick a soldier? I mean, is that pretty accurate? Or
no. I'm not offended by whatever people call. You know what I always say? I don't care if you like the books. I don't care if you read the books. Just buy the books.
There's the lesson for today, folks.
Yeah. No, that's the point. The point about art is you put it out there, and people are going to feel how they feel about it. Now, obviously, if I've managed to get 30-plus novels published, a few lunatics out there think I'm worthy of it. And also, I'm not offended by being called an artist. You know, a lot of writers don't want to take credit for the art. And I try very hard to be artistic in my writing, but not so much so that the reader ever thinks, oh, Reed Coleman wrote this. I never, ever, ever want a reader to think about me while they're reading. I want them to lose themselves in the book. I mean, that's the whole point. As I always say, I look at writing as me giving the reader enough information to make the movie in his or her own head. So I never want them to think about me, but I don't think there's anything wrong with trying to be artful or poetic or emotional or, Pelicanos does it too.
Right.
And not in an obvious way. I mean, Michael Connelly does it. I mean, Phillips does it. You can do it. I mean, that's good writing. In good writing, there's all sorts of good writing. But I'm never offended by what, especially if they buy the book.
well, let me just follow up with this. I mean, and again, for the sake of a podcast, I was doing the schlub versus soldier, but let's go down that road. I mean, you were able to take Mo Prager, a totally different kind of person than what you created in Nick. But was it harder to flesh out a soldier versus a schlub? You know, if I can continue to use that term. Yeah.
Well, you know, Mo is more like me than Nick is like me. So it was easier to do a Jewish guy from Brooklyn, because right. I'm a Jewish guy from Brooklyn, whose backstory is different than Mo's, but whose life is not that different from Mo's. So that was relatively easy. But the fun for me, as I think it is for all, it's like making shit up. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
So if you're gonna make shit up, you should do as good a job as you can at it. And so even though Nick is nothing like me, that was a lot of fun for me to create a character who really isn't much like me. but a street, you know, streetwise, very competent. I always say the battle for me between my characters is a guy like Nick is uber competent at what he does.
Right.
Oh, and a lot, and Gus and some other of my characters, I've written several series, are stumblers. So stumblers, it's great writing stumblers, but it's easy to write stumblers because they're always putting themselves in positions they shouldn't be in, but they don't know any better.
And that drives the story, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And that drives the story, and that makes life easier as a writer. Nick was challenging, and I couldn't do that. He is not the type of guy to stumble into the situation. He has to be put in it by somebody else, and that was what was fun for me with Nick.
Well, then here's a craft question then. I mean, one is in first person, the other's in third person. Did that help in terms of creating those characters and driving the story, or is that just something you just did?
No, I think you know, and I think Delia will back me up on this. You have to decide how the global size of your story. As my friend writer Peter Spiegelman once said, my first person, my Mo books, it's like Mo sitting in the driver's seat and the reader sitting next to him and telling him the story as they drive cross country. So it's a very personal kind of storytelling. Whereas Nick, the world is a bigger world. And a larger, more encompassing. So third person works better because you don't only have to show Nick's perspective all the time.
Well, when you create these stories, it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, the Robert B. Parker series or Mo or Nick or anybody. I mean, do you create the cage? I'm not going to use the outline versus panzer trope that everybody's overusing that. Yeah. But I mean, yeah. You create the scaffolding and the cage and then kind of come in and sprinkle the art fairy dust, or is that just pouring out of you naturally?
I'm built that way. I just sit down and start writing. It's just the way I'm built. I would never recommend it to people unless they're built the same way I'm built. And I've always been built in, you know, I have an idea. I just wrote a short story in 2 days. That I had an idea for. I didn't know exactly where it was going. And 2 days later, 4,500 words, the story's finished. That's just how I'm built. I once wrote a Mo book, Hurt Machine, where the only thing I knew when I sat down to write it was Mo is sick. That's it. And I sat down and wrote a 300-page book. But that's just the way I'm built. And if you're built that way, great. If you're not built like Deaver, right?
You know Deaver. Yes, I do.
Deaver with his Fakata forever, you know.
Outlines.
Yeah. I mean, I would jump off a building writing those outlines.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, can you argue with his success? No.
Well, have you ever been forced, coaxed, asked to try to teach that? Is that something that can be taught or is it's got to flow?
But the way I do it, I don't think you can teach it. I would say if I have a talent, that's my talent. And I don't think you can teach talent. But if people have a little talent, hard work goes a long way.
Okay.
So I mean, talent is requisite, but not sufficient. And hard work, believe me, you just need a little bit. I think a lot of writers have a little bit of talent and have gotten very far. So,
okay. Well, let's on that note, I'm going to shift to Delia and
wait a minute. What?
Yeah. Cause you've put in the work.
Oh, I thought you were going to say I was an exemplar of a little bit of talent.
No. Hey, yeah. Well, you know, look, I'm trying to keep it real here. Keep it on the edge.
Yeah.
Okay. We've got to see some Jerry Springer stuff, you know.
Yeah, right.
Well, Ms. Delia, you know, I'm gonna hit you with something totally different, putting you on the spot here. Okay.
Okay.
Now, I have a very troubling thesis here, and I don't think it's dubious. But hear me out, and if I'm full of shit, smack me down, okay? Trouble in Queenston, you know, when I see Trouble in Queenston, I remember the thing on HBO, Mayor of Easttown, you know. These are very bleak, and on TV, shot almost colorless, kind of lower middle class suburbs, sitting out there on the edge of the, between the rural and the metropolis, you know, New York or Philly, you know, depending. But the cover art for your novel, and then, you know, the sequel had a lot more color to it. And, you know, and as African-Americans, you know, we all have stories about editorial issues and cover art and everything. My weird theory is, do you think that because you're a woman, because you are an African-American woman, that by using these bright colors, they're maybe trying to trick some people, maybe female readers, into thinking it's domestic suspense, which is a big thing, or even a cozy? So, you know, am I full of shit, or is it all coincidence, or is it a little bit of of all that?
Well, first of all, those are questions you'd have to put to the publishers.
Of course, but I'm asking you.
I can guarantee you I'm not an artist. I'm a writer, and I know my limits. I have a lot of sense about taste and good taste and bad taste, and I have a lot of opinions. You may know that I published 6 books in a different series.
Right.
I self-published them, and right. I was all over the creation of those covers, the titles, and every last little minute aspect of those 6 books was me.
Right.
That is not true for
we're going to talk about that later, but go ahead.
By Macmillan, by Bhatnagar. Right. I did not pick those covers. I love them. I came to love them. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
I did not. It was not what was in my head. And I remember suggesting all kinds of wild things, and those were not what.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying they're bad covers.
I think they're beautiful. I'm very happy.
It was just, you know, when I think of these towns, and I think of, you know, the plot, you know, especially of Trouble in Queenstown, and I think of this kind of gray. And I think of this, you know, these people trying to, you know, they're out here again. They're in that weird pocket between, you know, the hinterland and this metropolis, you know, a couple of exits off whatever parkway there might be out there. And I just couldn't see all the colors.
Well,
there's something about that.
As I've said earlier, one thing that first struck me when we first moved here in 2001 was, frankly, how diverse the community was. When
kids
went to started high school that year, and I read some literature about the school district in my town, and it mentioned, it claimed that there were 55 different languages spoken in the homes of students who attended schools in our district. And that really struck me. And I have to say, that was one of the inspirations for my starting this current series with Vandy Myrick as the lead investigator. Because I said, people present small towns as very bland, as sort of milk and whey colored. Mm-hmm. And that is not the case in the town where we're living.
Okay.
And it's definitely not the town that I would want to present in a story. I just don't think it's that interesting. So I said, this is something that ought to be presented in private eye fiction. I've always loved private eye fiction. I love Mo, by the way. I don't think he's a schlub at all.
I was throwing that out there.
I was about to jump in, but I let you go on with that. But no, I don't think that the town that I live in, nor the town that I attempted to depict through these stories, this fictional town, is at all gray or dark in that sense.
Okay.
I think one thing that I tried to bring out in some of the little poetry elements that I threw in have to do with the backstory of the town.
Right.
It's a revolutionary era town. People have been living in this very community, and more or less the same people, not, I would have to admit, the East Asians, but African-Americans, white Americans of every kind of background and ilk, have been living in this same area most of them doing the same things in many cases since long before the Civil War, long before the American Revolution.
Yeah.
We have monuments in our city to in town to soldiers from all of those wars. And in fact, I wove in a monument in as a little marker to the edge of what I call the Black community in these are all obviously fictional. I made it up, the flats. There's no, that I know of, no community like that in my town. But the fact of the matter is there is a lot of history going back older than the Republic. And then in addition, our a newer element, we have a large, in our town, my current correct non-fictional town, we have a large Latino population. We have people who come from all over Central America, Latin America, the Caribbean. We were a sanctuary city before it was popular and then before it was unpopular. We were have been a sanctuary city and defied the feds on that for 10 years now. So there's a lot. There are ICE raids here. This is a very diverse and mixed in every way that you can think about it in terms of ethnic background, religious background, in terms of there's a significant Jewish community. There is we're Sheikh by Jowl with a wonderful, interesting community called Roosevelt, which is a I think of it as a workers' paradise. It was founded by Jewish textile workers who left New York City in the 1930s and came to literally Cheek by Jowl with the Windsors and set up a new town. They called it Roosevelt, unsurprisingly, and have been shown murals on the public walls of their of the 1930s era public schools there. No, this community is very diverse.
Well, thank you for that, because that's what I was going to say is that, you know, for literally centuries, what they were doing in these towns was feeding the growth of whatever metropolis was near, you know, and I think, and that was going back to that Mirror of Easttown. I mean, that was a theme there, is that that town was a mill town that fed the growth of Philadelphia from when, you know, before the United States, just like these towns in New Jersey fed the growth of New York, you know, since before the revolution. So,
Philadelphia.
Yeah.
All of that.
What I find interesting about your town as opposed to my town, because if you know Long Island, Long Island is a very segregated place, very segregated. And it's not segregated in the obvious ways that it's segregated because we have 133 school districts on Long Island. And so they're segregated by property taxes.
Yeah.
So there's no need for burning crosses. My kids went to a high school that had 3,000 kids in it. There were two Jews in their classes and not a lot of African Americans. Some Latino kids, because on Long Island, it's very heavily these days Latino, which is fine with me. But it's as opposed to your town, which which is where, you know, one would wish things would be like. I wrote a whole series in which I talk, Gus Murphy series, in which I discuss this very issue. That I think that's the funny thing. I think, Delia, you probably love PI fiction for some of the same reasons I love PI fiction, because you can talk about any serious subject that you want to talk about while people are not paying attention. So it's the magician's trick.
I agree.
I love PI fiction for that
reason. Reed just stole my next question,
way. Let me just, however, follow up on one thing that Reed said. Let me follow up on one thing. You talked about burning crosses. Hightstown, which is the town next to my, we are sort of the donut hole, and Hightstown is the donut hole within East Windsor, where I live.
Right.
Hightstown in the 1920s was the center for Central and South New Jersey of the Ku Klux Klan. This was the sort of I wouldn't say it wasn't the birthplace of it, but it was the headquarters of it. And that's one of the elements I wove in to the first book, To Trouble in Queenstown, was that there were people who still adhered to some of those basic principles. And it has also an historical basis. So I think I'm an historian by my own training. And I think that without, as you said, without hitting people over the head with it, a PI story is a great place to put in the history, the cultural issues, all of those kinds of questions. They don't have to.
This is for both of you. I mean, did that form your drive to write these stories, or was it just one factor? I mean, why not police procedurals? You know, why not a cozy? You know, I mean, what was the, what formed that drive besides the historical?
I don't have talents either in policemanship, police work, nor in cooking. So that those were not options that I was going to follow. I would have had to do more research if I wanted to make my books in either of those fields, then, and I'm not a knitter either. So I knew, and Reed, you're absolutely right. I've loved PI fiction. I've loved PI stories. I remember in Chicago watching as a preteen on the late night movies that came after the news, watching Alan Ladd movies, watching Jimmy Cagney movies, watching these films that I don't know. My parents, I think, probably fell asleep and were not sure what I was watching at that hour. And loving those movies, loving The Blue Dahlia, loving Postman Always Rings Twice, and loving them from before I was, as I say, before I was a teenager. And so that was always something that I wanted to write. And I think that definitely influenced the point of view that I took, because I couldn't hear a PI story as anything other than first person. I can write other kinds of things, and I have done. I love writing in close third person, but for me, the PI story has got to come in my head, comes as a first person story.
Yeah. Plus, when you're writing it, you can hear the voice telling
absolutely
the story. As you, it's almost as if it's moving your fingers on the keyboard.
Absolutely.
And for PI fiction, I have to say, I agree. I can probably write a PI novel in third person. I would not enjoy it nearly as much. Right. I have written police procedurals. I've written standalones. I've written stuff that aren't that stuff, science fiction. But to tell you the truth, I will always, my first love will always be first person PI novels for all the reasons we talked about.
Yes.
Well, let me piggyback on that though, Reed. I mean, when you have a character like Nick, and you have social issues, I mean, stuff with the cops and racial problems in the city, is it because he's a, you know, he was trained as a soldier, is the social commentary his reaction to what's going on, where he's I serve NYPD, but if something messed up has happened, that forms the conflict in my brain. I mean, how is that where the social commentary comes
it's
in?
The conflict for Nick. I mean, for people who don't know, the first Nick book, Sleepless City, a police officer, because he's not really competent in his job, kills an African-American teenager and a white girl on a staircase in the projects. And Nick, and this is in the midst of, after several shootings by police of African-American teenagers. And Nick is faced with the problem. Do you let the city burn? Because what happens when the city burns? Who gets it the worst?
Yeah.
The African-American community always gets the shit end of the stick, as we used to say in my lovely neighborhood growing up. So does he kind of cover it up to prevent that? Or so there's the conflict. I mean, I loved putting him in that position. Because what would you do in that position? What? And then I also have his friend, his African-American friend, who kind of intuits that he's done this and is mad at him for doing it. You know, sometimes you got to let the crops burn, you know.
Right.
So to me, that's the joy of writing these books is mm-hmm. I love the character, but I also love sticking them in the hardest, most difficult mm-hmm. kinds of situations.
So you wouldn't characterize Sleepless or the other one as detective fiction, then? It's more kind of weird...
No, it's police procedural with a big, heavy element of, moral questions, not for me, but for the readers. What would you do? It's easy to judge, you know, from where we sit. It's much harder when you're in the midst of it. So that's the fun for me.
Mm-hmm. So, well, Delia, I mean, your character was a cop.
Right.
You know, so, and, you know, wasn't necessarily enamored of, you know, being on the force. I mean, not, you know, mm-hmm. wasn't drummed out, but I mean, you know, it just wasn't for her. Like some people leave the military and like, that wasn't for me. I mean, for you, it seemed to be more of a traditional, and I'm talking about the Nick Ryan books, but even with some of your detective fiction, there seems to be less of a problem with the cops as, say, with your novel, Delia, and with other detective novels, where I guess this goes back to Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, the first crime book written, that's the invention of the bumbling cops trope, is that these guys... These MFs don't know what they're doing. I can figure this out. They're either going to tag it on somebody who didn't do it or be lazy, blah, blah, blah. And this was written in 1841. It looks like, Delia, your police axis seems to be closer to that. I'm not going to say trope, but closer to that, you know, thing where, you know, they're after somebody else because it's either convenient or there are other reasons. Whereas Reed, yours, the police seem to be out there doing their job. There's nothing nefarious. It's just that you've got the Seamus out here tracking down or bumbling into something that's totally not what they looked at.
I think it's important, though, that it, certainly in what I try.
Oh, go ahead, Delia, and then Reed. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned me, so I was going to pick it up.
Oh, I know. Yeah, don't worry, Professor. I know.
No, no. I just think that. I think it's. I didn't want the police to be the easy fall guy. Because I didn't think that was very interesting anymore.
Right.
But I definitely did not want them to be the heroes, because I think that that's simply not an accurate reflection of how we live today. And I had an African American private eye, I wanted to be realistic about how she interacted with the cops, but they're different cops at different levels. I wanted to present the chief cop in this town that I invented is African American and is in fact an ex-boyfriend of hers, so she knows him quite well. But there's a lot of other cops that she doesn't know as well, and I wanted it to be very I hoped it was very nuanced. That, however, she understands very well, having grown up with a dad who was a cop. Also, I wanted that in there. I wanted there to be multiple angles on who was a police officer. She is not one. She was one. So I didn't want this to be an anti-cop screed, but I wanted it to be clear that the reason she steps into the story is because she recognizes that justice is not going to be served by relying on the traditional forces in the traditional avenues, that the Black community, the Latino communities are underserved, if they're served at all in this town. And that's one of the breaches into which she steps as a private investigator. And also, of course, being a private investigator, it gives you a lot more leeway a lot more leeway, as Reed said, to make shit up, because that's what they have to do as they do their jobs.
Ed McBain once said, the next time a private eye solves a murder, it'll be the first time. So it's fun. I mean, that's not true anymore, but it is an interesting thing because, of course, we have PIs in our books do things that PIs, you know, PIs mostly sit at a computer. Yeah. and take pictures of cracks in sidewalks.
Right.
And catch guys on roofs who have disability claims. I mean, that's right. Mostly what they do.
Right.
But what fun is that, right?
Right.
And I would say, and Chris, of course, I can't expect anybody interviewing me to have read all of my books.
Right.
You know, but if you have read all of my books, you will see that I actually have a fairly not jaundiced view, but I have a fairly honest view of cops in that I know a lot of them, and that some of them are very good and very honest and very, and a lot of cops are shitty and racist. And if you read my books, you'll see that
covers
the spectrum. On one hand, I can admire cops because it is a risky job. On the other hand, it could be an awfully boring job. And the bottom line is cop to cop, which is an interesting thing because they're usually a mix of all of those things I just said.
Yeah.
I think Delia probably sees it the same way. Mm-hmm. Cops are like everybody else.
Right.
There's a real mix amongst them. And I know some who are, utterly racist. There's no denying there's a strain of that in the police. I also think that what's going on with ICE really hurts the respect that people have for all uniformed
officers.
And that I think... I'm not going to write the book, but I think it would be an interesting book to see the position that this puts currently working cops in, because they, on the one hand, feel they need to support uniformed officers, but on the other, smart cops realize this really lowers the respect that everyone has for all uniformed officers. So, you see, there's a book there.
I agree. In my first, that first book, I have a scene of a town council meeting in this fictional Queenstown where the subject is, should we or should we not reassert our sanctuary city? This was written before the current reelection and the current administration. And I have the private eye confront her friend, the police chief, after that town council meeting and say, why didn't you speak out? And he says, because he can't speak out against the city government of which he is a part. But he knows that he's not going to be able to do his job as well, particularly in the Latino community, because he will lose the collaboration and cooperation of members of that community who want peace and quiet in their community. But if ICE is allowed in, he says this. And this is, as I say, written, 5 years ago when I wrote this, because sanctuary city issues were an issue in our real town. I knew this to be concerns. And this is not in the context of the current situation. It preceded that, but I felt sort of, I don't want to say clairvoyant, but it was certainly ahead of things.
Let's face it. If you're a good observer of life, it ain't simple. Life isn't simple. It isn't black and white. Most people's moral compass falls in this gray area, situational, and it's gray. And that's what makes for interesting books and interesting writing. I think when you the old classic black hat, white hat, just bores the shit out of
me.
Like, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in books that present more really deep moral questions, like Mosley's, E.Z. Rollins'
book. Right.
I actually have a disagreement with Walter about this, and because I respect writers who make their protagonists make the hard moral choices, not have Mouse.
Right.
The psycho ex machina.
He's the repository.
Psycho Ex Machinas.
Right.
Will do the dirty work. Mm-hmm. I more respect.
Have you copyrighted that term, Psycho Ex
Machina?
Because I might use it.
No, but my picture is next to it in the dictionary.
Right. I wasn't trying to overgeneralize about cops. It's just that these tropes have developed. Oh, okay. These tropes have developed. I mean, since Murders in the Rue Morgue, I mean, they were going in one direction. The sleuth is going the other. And naturally, you have to go with the sleuth because that's what drives the story. But let me ask you about this then. I mean, have you ever felt, I'm talking about tropes, pressured by an editor to add more twists or to over dramatize or melodramatize a twist? Is that something you've experienced or seen? Either of you?
Go ahead, Delia.
Well, I'm working on the copy edits of the third book in the Vandy Myrick series today, and it will come out in December, the third book.
Right.
And yes, the editor wasn't over dramatizing, but she did say, can you add more suspects? She thought I had gone too hard, or maybe she just reads me too well. She figured that she knew too much too early about who the bad twists were and where they were going. And she wanted me to add more, not bad, because actually they ended up being not bad characters, but characters with motives. And she made that suggestion. It was, I think, a very good suggestion. And
They
were in my head, and it was funny. That was one of the easiest revisions I made to any book that I've ever written, because they just came out of me in a snap, the new characters and they fit right in. They slid in without any, I don't know. Maybe they were always in there and I just hadn't pulled them out. Yeah. I don't know. But that did not pose a problem. But she specifically said, can you add another level of character who could muddy the water a little more for the reader? And of course, for the detective, as she's thinking about who did it. And she was right, the editor. And
what about you, Reed? Anything? You're lucky she was right, Delia, yeah, by the way, but go ahead, Reed.
I've never had an editor ever tell me to up the plot, you know, the plot twisting. I have, on the other hand, when I was writing the Jesse Stone series, and there was a book called The Hangman's Sonnet in the Jesse Stone series, where my editor asked me to take a character out.
Oh, okay.
And that is a lot harder than putting a character in, because once a character's in a book, you have to find, it's like taking a single thread out of a coat without ruining the coat. And it was, that was about the hardest editorial thing I ever had to do. So I've had the opposite problem that Delia had, and it was really difficult thing to do. It was the right thing to do. The editor was right, but boy, I was not happy at the prospect of doing it.
Wow. I mean, that's a good, you know, and for people watching or listening, I mean, you know, that's good that you've had two great outcomes with that, because a lot of times there aren't great outcomes. There's a lot of conflict. Well, let me ask you this then, getting to specifically to noir, and you know, drawing on the last question, I mean, is noir that conducive to this industry-wide now need to have twistiness and turns and twists and turns and twists and turns? I mean, you don't see a lot of that in classic noir novels or in noir film. You know, there's a pretty straight current going. I mean, there are eddies, and then the action takes place in the eddies, but there isn't a lot of just stuff inserted and red herrings just to drive you crazy, to turn the page, you know, as you're reading it in the beach kind of a thing. I mean, is noir really set up for that, or is it set up to just be kind of like get you with the story and get you with the characters?
I think cozies are more set up for the red herring and the, you know, or locked room mysteries or traditional mysteries.
Right.
So I think noir is more character driven. I think domestic suspense is actually a pretty close offshoot of noir, because as I think James Ellroy once, when asked what noir was, said, everybody's fucked on page one and things get worse from there.
I was going to say a variation of that.
Not yeah, but no, you're right.
but I think that noir is about people, the detective that is the centerpiece, but all the other characters making bad decisions, understandably human decisions, perhaps, but bad ones, and then the consequences coming down on their heads and working their way through those. So I think that I consider those the twists. That's a part of the twist. Right, you're going, okay. If you aren't, every once in a while say, no, don't do that.
Right.
Don't choose that person. Don't choose to go in that way. Don't do
that
this.
It has to be organic to the character. I think noir, because you've set it, because of the way noir is set up, it's organic to the characters to make bad decisions. It's organic, or to make a decision, not necessarily a bad decision, but one in which most people wouldn't make it because they would be afraid to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And noir, of course, has a million different definitions. And I think the greatest compliment I ever got was I was on a panel with Eddie Muller. The czar of noir. And I said, Eddie, I'm not really a noir writer. And I'm more hard boiled. And he said, Reed, you're absolutely a noir writer, because in your books, the truth always makes things worse.
Okay. I have to write that down. I like that.
Yeah. Interesting. Good. My editor, the first editor, I use the term noir. I use the term for my previous series. I called it neighborhood noir because I wanted to emphasize that this was noir, but it was taking place in small towns and so on. That was my previous series. And I still like that turn of phrase in my own head. But one of my editors said she didn't like the term noir because to her, it sounded macho. It seemed to exclude a lot of the things that I was very actively including in my stories, which was a very active and assertive but vulnerable female lead. And that, in her view, the term noir did not admit to that. I don't necessarily agree with her.
Yeah, I think that's incorrect, actually.
Yeah.
But well, I'm just saying that was
you look
her.
Back at, she didn't like it. You, I think your instinct is right. Because if you look back at noir films are full of strong female characters. Not always the femme fatales,
right,
but often strong-minded characters. Look at Double Indemnity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she is way more powerful than he is.
Look at the movie Out of the Past, where
she
shoots people and betrays them, and it's great.
Well, at least the editor didn't say it sounds too French to me.
Right. the other definition that people, I guess, misuse, and I've heard, on this show, we've discussed this too, is that it's all about atmosphere. It's really not about the organic flow of the characters in the story. It's the fog and the shadows and the grit and this city and that city. And how do you think that happened? I mean, is that a cultural thing and people just have lost touch with what the term really means? Either of you.
I suspect that is a superficial viewing of what noir is. And the best noir is all about character. I mean, it really is about character. The best noir writing and the best noir films are about character. I mean, Touch of Evil. Let's have somebody watch Touch of Evil and let them tell me it's not about the character, it's about atmosphere. The atmosphere and the characters are wedded in the best noir. atmosphere and character are wedded together and one reflects the other.
Right.
Exactly.
But to just say it's about fog and shadow, you know, that's just a superficial opinion.
This is just from younger people. I've heard this, right. You know, and, no. Or what they try to say is that atmosphere is a character. You have your human characters and the atmosphere, mm-hmm. the noir atmosphere is the other character, and which sounds a little weird too.
And this is why I enjoyed playing with some of those tropes by having my story set in a small town, because it still is a small town, but yet not being cozy and not being chummy, although people do tend to know each other and they know a lot more about each other. But I think that that's one of the things that you can play against is you can have a sunny noir. You can have a noir theme because I agree with Reed, absolutely, it's based on character. And as we mentioned before, those choices that are derived from the characters that we've created and put on the page, and then we set them in motion and they make all sorts of questionable choices and work their way into and out of trouble because of those, some of them compulsions that they have to take. Decisions, but it can be they don't have to have shadows and rainy nights and slanted Venetian blinds and smoke filled nightclubs,
camera shots,
right? Or Orson Welles and the third man type crap.
But they can.
They can.
And by the way, I agree. I think, Delia, you're absolutely right in that. I think small towns are actually a perfect setting for noir, for the reasons there's secrets, and there's also people who know everything about each other. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, in a big city, what happens on one block has no effect on what happens on the next block. Mm-hmm. You're from Chicago, I'm from Brooklyn. You know, no one cares what the individuals. If you're on a subway car with 100 people or 200 people. You know, they get off the car. It's not, but in a small town, people are.
The town is the subway car.
More interesting. It is. It's a subway car.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So let me, we're going to wrap up pretty soon. What are you guys working on now? And where do you see as the future? I know it's kind of a tropish question, but what do you see as the future, Hard-Boiled and P.I.? Let's start with what are you working on now, and then what do you see as the future?
Go ahead, we'll end on that. Well, we know what Delia's working on.
Yeah, that's true. She just said.
I've got to get to my edits right now, although I will say I'm pleased so far. I'm about a third of the way through the chapters, and it's very light. Their editing has been very light, and I'm grateful for that and hoping the same is true for the rest of it. I'm working now on a collaborative work that I'm putting together with another, I think, very good noir writer. And he and I are putting together a contemporary, I guess you could say it's a road story thriller with an African-American woman who starts off in the first chapter killing her husband.
Okay.
Has to get away, and she relies on a white separatist, white supremacist adjacent ex-con as her chauffeur, and things take off from there.
All right.
That's a setup.
I know.
That's a setup.
Tell my wife that.
That's a setup.
It's fun. It's fun, and it's very dark. It's much darker than things I've written. It's more violent, but it's also more touching and affecting. It's not a love story. It's not a romance. It's an adventure.
All right. What about you, my friend?
Well, I believe it or not, I just finished a short story for an anthology this morning for the anthology called Golf Noir.
All right. I saw Tennis Noir. I know John Shepherd did that.
Yeah, John Shepherd.
Yeah.
And I'm a golfer. So John Shepherd's not much of a golfer.
You heard it here.
yeah. Rory McIlroy has no worries about John Shepherd.
Golf Noir.
So I just finished that today, but there's something interesting going on. I was kind of in between projects, and my agent and I are discussing one, but I started writing a short Mo story. I don't write Mo books anymore, but I do write the occasional Mo short story. And this is the kind of magic that happens when you don't have a plan. So as I'm writing this story, I'm saying, this is not a short story. This is a book. Mm-hmm. So there are 9 Mo books, but there might be a 10th.
Ooh, okay. Okay, fingers and toes crossed here. Well, guys, thank you. This has been just fantastic. And again, I mean, at the outset, you heard the word honor. I mean, it's an honor to have you all on here. And I'm hoping that people take a lot from this conversation, you know, because I was trying to, you know, I think I got the answers I was looking for everybody to take from this. I think it's going to be really, really great for people who are fans, readers, and our peers too. And that's the wonderful thing about the awards that you all have earned, is that, you know, most of them have been curated by your peers. I mean, these are people who are like saying, look, Reed and Delia, they're one of us and they're among the best. And thank you guys for being on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, what fun. Thank you all. Folks, you are listening to Chris Chambers Noir with best-selling noir storyteller Chris Chambers. Go to chrischambersnoir.com. And we are here with amazing authors, Reed Coleman and Delia Pitts. We can't thank you all enough for being here, our authors and our listeners and our viewers. Stay tuned for more episodes. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV, and all the incandescent things. So keep shining, keep being dark, but bringing in the light. How's that? I'm a
fan. Yeah, that was good.
Perfect.
Bye, guys.
All right, y'all. We'll see you again.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.